The political climate in America has changed. We've been given a reprieve, and we have to work together to take advantage of that momentum and effect even more cultural and spiritual change. We can rebuild America. The American Family Association is working to do just that, and when you join with your support, it helps maximize the impact. As our thanks, we'll give you a DVD of biblical financial advice from Rob West called Biblical Stewardship. Please visit afa.net and get started today.
Welcome to Today's Issues. Join us for the next hour as we offer a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Ed Vitagliano.
And welcome to Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman this week. It is Wednesday, May 28th. Joining me in studio, Fred Jackson. Good morning, Fred.
Hello, Ed.
And Chris Woodward. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's the middle of the week, the middle of the last week in May. We're about to head into June. Summer's going to be right around the corner, and we're going to be soon talking about how we're halfway through the year, and man, things have been just a freight train of events and things going on. And Chris, you're going to start us off with the first news item of the day.
Yes. Well, there has been a lot of coverage this morning, and understandably so, continuing coverage, I should say. Of Jake Tapper and this book that he wrote with a guy named Alex Thompson. Jake Tapper is from CNN. Alex Thompson is a journalist. And they co-wrote a book that they claim reveals people conspired together to cover up Joe Biden's mental state before, during, and even after the presidential campaign from 2020 on through 2024. And it's gotten to the point now where even Jake Tapper is claiming that the Biden scandal, he calls it, was worse than Watergate. I want to begin here and go through several clips here. Let's hear from Jake Tapper from the beginning. Clip one.
It is an entirely separate scandal. It is a scandal.
Yes.
It is without question, and maybe even worse than Watergate in some ways.
Right.
Because Richard Nixon was in control of his faculties when he wasn't drinking.
Now, I want to stop here for a moment because Watergate happened long before I was born. You remember Watergate unfolding. You were not working in news, but you saw it happen.
No, and I was probably in junior high school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the junior high school, early high school years. But yeah. I do remember being in a grocery store standing in line, and over the intercom, they were playing Richard Nixon's resignation. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, it was a stunning turn of events. So I find it interesting, Fred. I'll toss this to you unless you want to.
I was just going to say, if there was indeed a cover up, and I'm just kind of removing myself to be the news guy here, if there was indeed a cover up, is it at least at the same level, if not worse than Watergate?
Oh, there was a cover up. There's no doubt that Richard Nixon tried to cover up the events of the break in at the Watergate Hotel. Interestingly, he had tapes of every conversation inside the Oval Office, and in part that is what, you know, led to Nixon's downfall. I'm not sure, Fred, I'll toss it to you first. I'm not sure this is on the same level as Watergate. I understand Jake Tapper's point that Richard Nixon had control of his faculties, but that was the president of the United States breaking the law and covering up. He did not instigate the break-in, as far as I remember, but he tried to cover that up. That was kind of a stunning revelation of what I'm guessing a lot of presidents did. Okay, he did kind of get caught, but this, I'm not sure that what surrounds President Joe Biden's mental decay is the same thing, because it wasn't Biden necessarily covering up, it was the people around him. But it's probably just splitting straws.
Yeah.
This is, I do agree with Jake Tapper, this is a scandal.
It is.
Because it was meant to influence an election, and the fact that Jake Tapper, along with others in the mainstream media, played along with this and participated in the cover-up, as well as apparently leadership in the Democratic Party and members of the Biden administration. They were all in on this, so it absolutely is a scandal.
Absolutely. 2 points I want to make. Chris says he wasn't born when Watergate came around, but his long-lost uncle, Bob Woodward, reported on it.
We got joining us now is my Uncle Carl.
No, that's Carl Bernstein.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, anyway, bad joke. Okay.
2 points. Yeah. It is laughable, at the very least, that Jake Tapper would call this a scandal. If he really believes it's a scandal, Jake Tapper is the worst anchor CNN ever had, because Fox, with some integrity, has been reporting on what Jake Tapper has said over the last year about Joe Biden, about, you know, denying, CNN and others, denying what was visible to 99% of the American public,
right,
that Joe Biden wasn't playing with a full deck. You know, everybody knew that. So everything that Jake Tapper is saying, now that he has a book out there, which I'm told is selling like hotcakes.
Yeah.
So he's making a whole pile of money.
Right.
So for Jake Tapper now to say, you know, it's just horrible what the Democrats did, and just horrible what the circle around Joe Biden did. I'm sorry. I just can't take Jake Tapper seriously. You know, it's just... these people knew what was going on. They hid it because Jake Tapper and the rest are closet Democrats.
They had their finger on the scale.
Yes.
And they were influencing,
yes,
trying to influence, and probably successfully influencing, maybe even way back as far as the 2020 election, but certainly trying to influence the 2024 election, when their job is to be the watchdog of government, not the paid shills for a particular political party in power.
Yeah.
To go with this, Fox did a segment on this today, spent a lot of time on Jake Tapper's comments that we just played for you guys. And then they brought in a Democrat representative named Ro Khanna. Khanna represents a portion of Silicon Valley out in California, and he says Dems should own up to this situation here. Clip two.
Well, I do have regrets for backing him for a second term. That was a mistake. I've said that the Democrats should own up to that. We should have pushed back against a lot of what we were hearing from the White House. I met him a few times. In those instances, he was fine. But the reality is he shouldn't have run. And I think the Democrats would be better just owning up and saying that was a mistake. The American people are fair, but we do have to take accountability.
Yep. Now, Lawrence B. Jones then pushed back on Representative Khanna, and I have that exchange here. Clip three.
Yeah, but Congressman, I think it's more than a mistake. A mistake is when I forget to put my right signal or my left signal on. The book outlines that it was intentional, and they, as long as he was breathing, that aides and members of Congress, the Democrat establishment, just wanted to keep him alive so they could get the agenda. So is this a massive cover-up?
Well, certainly not that I know of. I mean, I met him a few times in the year. He was perfectly fine. But I do think what the mistake was that we should have pushed back more against the old guard and insisted on new voices. And now you're seeing that in the Democratic Party. You're seeing a lot of new voices there. You're seeing a demand for the old guard to step aside. And you're seeing a focus on the economy, of a real vision of how we're going to raise wages, get new jobs.
Now, he's talked about how he met him a few times and he was fine. From what we gather from the book that Tapper and Alex Thompson wrote, there were people that were literally like, you know, these are the times that you can see Joe. He's at his best today. He's all there. All the lights are on in the White House, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So anybody that says I met him and he seemed fine, I don't think we can just go with that.
Well, I mean, for someone like that, the congressman, there probably won't be any consequences. Because we weren't there when he, quote unquote, met with President Biden on occasion. So it's entirely possible that Joe Biden was more lucid on certain days than on others. But, Fred, it seems clear that the way this whole thing unfolded, we've talked about this on the program a lot because it's 2025. We go all the way back to 2020, that when it became apparent that that the radical left, represented by Bernie Sanders, had a real shot at the nomination, that what the Democratic Party establishment did was metaphorically or literally get everybody into the same room. And I think Amy Klobuchar was not doing bad. And everyone in and say, look, we need to get Joe Biden the nomination. Got black leaders in because South Carolina was coming up in the primary season in 2020. We have to get Joe elected because we can't have Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist, run against Donald Trump because Trump will win re-election. And we all know about Trump derangement syndrome, and everybody agreed. And I think the deal that was cut with Bernie Sanders and the radical left is, okay, if we do this and Joe Biden gets in, then we want our agenda being represented by the Biden administration. And as it all turned out, whatever you think of the 2020 election, Biden did win the nomination. He got elected. And the left, between 2020 and 2024, came calling for their payoff.
Yeah.
And the only thing that mattered was getting that agenda, continuing the agenda under Biden, and getting him a second term so the agenda could take root in this country. And the people who made deals in 2020 made a deal with the devil in covering up Joe Biden's obvious impairment. Listen, there are people who are questioning whether Jill Biden should have told her own husband, you don't need to run again, but she was all in as well.
Yeah. I have a theory.
Okay.
So we'll go back to 2020. Barack Obama looked at the field. Like you, there was concern. Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
These other people. Let's put Uncle Joe and all kind of surround the wagons around Joe. Get him in there. And Barack Obama thought, and then I'll put my people in close contact with Joe Biden once he gets in the White House. Because I don't think it's even speculation anymore. It was Barack Obama's people that ran the White House for Joe Biden. His very close individuals that were part of the Obama administration then became part and were running the show for Biden. That is why you had such a left-wing agenda that manifested itself as soon as Joe Biden got in there. I think that the whole game plan was being run. I think Barack Obama was the coach. He wasn't the president anymore, but he was the coach. Joe Biden happened to wear the captain's sweater.
Yeah.
All right? And he was out there for the public, and he did what he was told. And even when his mental capacity began to deteriorate, they were okay with that because, you know, what did they call it? The electric pen or something like that?
The auto pen.
Auto pen.
The auto pen. We'll just use the auto pen. And that's what went on. Somebody was talking the other day that in order for Biden to have some credibility, the White House created a kind of an Oval Office background.
Yeah, it was a fabricated Oval Office.
Yes, and they said they had to make it big so that Joe Biden could read the print on the teleprompter.
Right.
You know, it was a lot of stuff is coming out right now, and then I believe as part of my theory is that when Barack Obama in 2024 saw that Joe Biden was a mental disaster, he then, never forget that scene in Los Angeles. Joe Biden's in Los Angeles campaigning. You remember Barack Obama coming up and grabbing him by the arm?
Yeah.
And leading him off stage. Mm-hmm. Within weeks after that, the knives came out. It was the whole June debate, the whole thing, and it was over. So I think Barack Obama ran the show for the 4 years of Joe Biden. I think he was instrumental in getting Biden to step away from things. They thought they had a chance with Kamala Harris, putting her in there. They could play up the female candidate, the black candidate, all of that. They could play that up, but it didn't work because the American people caught on.
Yeah, because there were several missteps on behalf of the Biden campaign, one of which was allowing him to debate.
Yes.
They could have covered Joe Biden, given political cover for Joe Biden refusing to debate mm-hmm. Donald Trump. They could have appealed to the fact, look, he's a felon. He's a disgrace. We're not going to dignify this man with a debate. Now, that would have come with some political cost,
mm-hmm.
but it would have been better than the disaster that befell Joe Biden mm-hmm. in that debate. By the way, remember, Barack Obama, this was reported by CNN and the New York Times, that when Joe Biden was considering running, Barack Obama said, you don't have to do this, Joe.
Mm.
Okay, this is before the 2020 race. I think Barack Obama was a shrewd enough political mind that he understood that they had to get some of the younger people in leadership. And we all remember the, 17 candidates running in the primaries. I don't think anybody wanted Joe Biden to be president, but it became apparent that they could not outwardly express the direction of the Democratic Party by allowing Bernie Sanders to get the nomination.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We just played that clip of Ro Khanna talking about, but we have new voices.
Yes, we do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those new voices are pretty scary.
Yes.
They're all radicals.
If you're talking about AOC, mm-hmm. you're talking about Crockett, you know, all of those individuals, do they really believe those voices are going to sell well to the American electorate?
Well,
I don't think so.
And the opposite, on the other side of the divide, you have old timers like James Carville
mm-hmm.
saying, no, they don't need to be the new voices.
Mm-hmm.
We need to come back towards the middle. So this kind of civil war within the Democratic Party really is just getting untracked.
Oh, yeah. Ron, we talked about Rahm Emanuel.
Yes.
The Wall Street Journal article the other day saying the party's image is toxic.
Yes.
I think that was the term he used.
And he said something else in woke. Oh, I forget the other, it's another W word, but.
Yeah. But he says we have to come back to the middle. So the Democratic Party has this great divide right now, which shows no sign of healing whatsoever.
Right. And Chris, to your point, as you played a couple of these clips, the Democratic Party is losing support in minority communities like mm-hmm. Black community, the Hispanic community, because the Republican Party right now looks like it's the party of the economy.
Yes.
And this was always a strength for the Democratic Party. The Republican Party was always seen as the party of law and order, military strength, projecting American influence around the globe. And the Democratic Party was seen as the party of the blue-collar worker.
Mm-hmm.
And it is losing that image. And if they continue with an emphasis on these radical policies, that will continue there'll be even more of a decline.
Very
in support.
True. Now, you're not the only one to say that. As a matter of fact, Kellyanne Conway was brought out on Fox this morning for a segment on all kinds of things, including this ongoing effort by the Democrats now to try to attract male voters. Democrats say we're losing males. We're going to do things to be more manly. We're going to appeal to males. We're going to sell the party on to males. And Kellyanne Conway says that's laughable. Clip 6.
Well, they tried this by putting Tim Walz on the ticket. And you remember, Tim Walz was like the left wing's idea of a really cool Midwestern guy who knows how to fire a gun, which he didn't. And he was as big a disaster as was the top of the ticket, Kamala Harris. It's really regrettable that the Democratic Party would have to spend $2, let alone $20 million, to learn about men. They're one half of our society. But look at the numbers. One half of young Latino men voted for Donald Trump. A third of young Black men. Over 60% of young white men. The swings among men overall, and all kinds of men, blue collar particularly, as Donald Trump has recast the Republican Party as the party of the worker, is undeniable.
I think what Trump has done is extraordinary. Okay. Now, part of that, I'm not sure, is a principled position on the part of Donald Trump in terms of when I say principled, I don't think he was purposefully saying, what can I do to draw young men, which is what the Democrats are doing,
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out how to do that. I think his approach was, I want to get this economy going so that people can work and they can, men can take care of their families. Mm-hmm. They can have good paying jobs so that young people can buy homes, all that kind of thing. And that, as a businessman,
yes,
in the White House, is what is drawing, I think, probably a lot of these young men. But also the transgender nonsense, I think, doesn't fly with men who are normally protective of women. And seeing other dudes, you know, spiking, you know, a volleyball into a girl's face, yep, and causing damage, they don't like that. And I think also the border, where all these, not all of them were criminals coming across the border, of course, but a lot of them were gang members and people who had committed crimes in their own country. And a lot of young men look at that, and the, and that protective nature kicks in at that time, too. And they think, you know what? I've got to protect my family or, you know, my parents, whatever. And I cannot, I do not want that border being unsecured.
I think the Democratic Party thought, they thought they could get away with the radical leftist agenda because they had the media on their side.
Right.
But what, here's what happened. A funny thing happened on the way. The mainstream of America started to understand where the mainstream media in this country was with its bias.
Yes.
And so they got fed up. So they stopped listening to the mainstream media, which supported Joe Biden's, well, it was an invasion, an right, orchestrated invasion on our southern border. It was really interesting this morning, and maybe we'll get to a little bit later in the program today, California's response to the latest threat from President Trump with regards to trans athletes,
yeah,
boys playing in girls' sports. I think as AP, NORC did a poll, 70% of Americans do not agree with biological boys playing in girls' teams. Biological boys being allowed to go into change rooms,
right,
girls' change rooms. This is just still common sense with common sense Americans.
Right.
But the, here's the problem for the Democratic. They can't move off of this.
No.
They cannot move off of
this. They can't reverse course.
No, they cannot. And so this is a huge problem. And even though the mainstream media may still be out there and they're protecting the Democratic Party on this front, when you got 70% of Americans not agreeing with the mainstream media or the Democratic Party, the question of the Democratic Party is, what are you going to do? Democratic Party, I think, has made one very tragic error. You know, when companies are sitting down and developing policies, they like to hear a spectrum of views.
Right.
You know, they're going to create a new widget, a right, company. They want to hear a perspective, you know, a whole perspective of views on this. The Democratic Party shut the door on anybody with conservative ideas. No, we don't want to hear from you.
Right.
We know what's best for the country. That kind of arrogant spirit caused them to lose this election. And unless things change, they're going nowhere in the midterms.
Well, and I'll tell you something else. We're coming up on a break, but we can, you know, possibly talk about this later on in the program. It's funny how public perceptions change. They don't always change like you think. Sometimes it takes time. So I'm thinking about the Bud Light fiasco,
oh, yeah,
with Dylan Mulvaney. Okay, those kinds of things. And by the way, that was a male who dressed like a female, identifying as a female, becoming the spokesperson, yeah, for Bud Light. The reaction to that among men, young men, mm-hmm, and just men,
yeah,
was so visceral.
Yes.
But it fed into all the other stuff that was hanging around in people's minds, I think, about how unfair it is to have men in women's sports and so on and so forth, that kind of turned the ship.
Yep.
Gradually, yes, but definitively turning the ship where people say this is wrong, and the party that thinks this is important, mm-hmm, when inflation's going through the roof,
mm-hmm,
that's a stain that's going to be very hard to scrub away for, mm-hmm, the Democratic Party, especially as you point out, Fred, they can't walk it back.
Nope.
They are all in, and, mm-hmm, that's why you see states like Maine and others saying, we don't care what the Trump administration says, we're sticking with men and women's sports. All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Jenna Ellis will be joining us. We'll be talking about some legal issues. You don't want to miss that. I hope you join us. When a woman experiences an unplanned pregnancy, she often feels alone and afraid. So many times her first response is to seek out an abortion. But because of the generosity of listeners like you, that search may lead her to a Preborn Network clinic. Preborn offers God's love and compassion to hurting women and then provides a free ultrasound to introduce them to the life growing inside them. This combination brings the ultimate miracle of life to life and doubles a baby's chance at life, which is why Preborn saw over 67,000 babies rescued last year alone. Meet Maddie. Maddie was in a tough situation as she wasn't sure who the father was. But after receiving counseling, prayer, and a free ultrasound at a Preborn Network clinic, everything changed. Maddie discovered she had twins and found the strength she needed to choose life. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. How many babies can you save? Please donate your best gift today. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com AFR. That's preborn.com AFR.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back to Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman this week. I'm joined in studio by Fred Jackson and Chris Woodward. Of course, Steve Paisley-Jordahl will be joining us after the top of the hour break. But in the meantime, we bring off the bench, as it were, Jenna Ellis, host of Jenna Ellis in the Morning, heard weekdays at 7 a.m. Central Time, and host of the On Demand podcast, found at AFR.net. Jenna, welcome back to Today's Issues.
Welcome, and to me, yes, and hi, and I didn't realize I had been benched, so glad to be off the bench, like,
well,
wow.
You had been benched, but you're not always on this show, the point I was making.
True.
We're kind of bringing you out of, how about the bullpen, let's say that.
Well, I was on vacation with my family for a while, so I deserve that a little bit, but, well, you know, it was a lot of fun. So.
I don't know why everyone always assumes that it's a wisecrack for me. I don't know why. I just try to mind my own business and encourage everybody. And yet I get this frequently, maybe even from the people who know me best. By the way, and if we have time, I do want to come back around to something you mentioned on your show this morning. I listened to your show. I try to listen to your show on the way into work every morning because it's a great program. And excellent job this morning. We're going to see if we can get a little bit of a comment or two from you about the conversation you had with Michael Ferris, because he is a treasure for the body of Christ. But first, and maybe the only issue we get to, depending. But Fred, what do you got for Jenna?
Yeah, Jenna, National Public Radio, better known as NPR, gets a lot of money. Your money, my money, Ed's money, taxpayers' money to do their programming. One would not describe their programming as fair and balanced. They have changed radically over the years, and they have joined the far left in their worldview and in their journalistic values. And so, no surprise, President Donald Trump doesn't think taxpayers should have to fund that left-wing bias. And so he is threatening to take their money away. And in response to that, National Public Radio and three local stations, public radio stations, filed a lawsuit yesterday against the president. Now, those who have been facing divisions that have been facing cuts in their funding have argued the president doesn't have the right to do that because only Congress has the right to take our funds away because Congress agreed to the funds. But I was taken by the argument that NPR is using. They're saying removal of our subsidies from the government is a violation of the First Amendment. And I thought, wait a minute, yes, you have First Amendment rights, but Jenna, they don't have a right to say the taxpayer must fund my point of view.
Right. Well, so a couple of things on this lawsuit. So Trump did sign a May 1st executive order for those who want to look it up. It's 14290. That's the number of the executive order. And it seeks to eliminate the federal funding for NPR. I agree with you that I think the separation of powers argument is the stronger one. I was actually talking to Steve Paisley-Jordahl about that yesterday for our news program. Also had on another attorney who frequents my program this morning who agreed with that position. So I think you know, there's kind of some consensus that the separation of powers is probably the best argument for NPR to say that if Congress were to change or modify or defund NPR, that would have to come through congressional legislation, not through the executive branch, this executive order. But as far as the First Amendment claim, NPR is claiming a First Amendment retaliation. So not that they have a constitutional right to taxpayer funding. It's not like they have applied for brand new and have been denied taxpayer funding and they're saying somehow that they have a right to it. What they're arguing, whether or not it prevails, but to clarify their argument, they are saying that because they have been funded, and that is a current status, that they're taxpayer funded, the only reason that Trump issued the executive order to take it away is in retaliation for them expressing constitutionally protected speech under the First Amendment. So it's really important to differentiate that. They're not saying that they have a right to it. They're saying that the executive order cutting funding was done in retaliation for disfavored content. And this is kind of a classic form of viewpoint discrimination.
But still, Jenna, to argue that Donald Trump has the wrong motive, he still has a right to say taxpayers of the country don't have an obligation to fund NPR.
Maybe. And that's really an issue for Congress to decide, right? And so if we think about this a different way, what if a conservative radio station was taking taxpayer funding, had congressional funding, and the Biden administration said, you know what, I don't really like that you're speaking against me, you're talking about God, for example, you are against gay marriage, some of those things, so I'm going to take away your taxpayer funding. We as conservatives would likely say, hey, you can't do that. We're expressing as a radio network, and not us, you know, obviously AFA and AFR, we're not funded by taxpayers, but if there were such an entity, then we would be saying, you know, you can't retaliate and remove our funding simply because you don't like that viewpoint. So the lawsuit hinges on retaliation and viewpoint discrimination, not just whether NPR has free speech rights kind of in the abstract. But I think really what we're doing is, and what we should be contemplating is whether or not in the First Amendment context, the First Amendment doesn't guarantee funding, but it does prohibit retaliation for protected speech. But that's the challenge that NPR is going to have to face. They will have to prove each and every element of First Amendment retaliation addition to separation of powers.
Okay, so the history here in the early 70s and I think part of the late 60s, Congress created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Okay, so that created not only National Public Radio, but also PBS, the public broadcasting service for television. So when people, you know, watch Sesame Street or whatever, that was on PBS, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I remember growing up and seeing, you know, watching Sesame Street. I think I was in high school. I will say this. Just as an aside, I did watch Sesame Street in high school because of those two old guys that were up in the balcony. I thought they were hilarious. But I remember when the show would go off, this program, you know, a product of the funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So the history of this, NPR and PBS are supposedly independent broadcasters created by Congress and funded by Congress. So my question is, Do you and apparently they were supposed to be independent and unbiased in what they put on, because they're supposed to serve the public good. So let me just ask you this question. Do you think that President Trump's decision to his desire to defund NPR, do you think it is retaliation?
That's a great question. And I think President Trump himself has basically expressed that it is, not in specific legal terms, but he's saying that he doesn't like what NPR is saying, so he thinks that their funding should be removed. And that's pretty classic retaliation. It's just whether or not that's prohibited by law, because some things are retaliation. So, for example, what Governor DeSantis did to the Reedy Creek District here in Florida over Disney's view of the quote-unquote Don't Say Gay bill. We all remember that controversy. And Disney argued unconstitutional First Amendment retaliation. They did not prevail on that case because the legislature took action for Reedy Creek, which was a government-created entity that doesn't get that type of First Amendment protection because it's a government entity. Here, NPR is not a government entity, so they can assert First Amendment claims. And so whether or not Trump's rhetoric and the action actually rises to the level of First Amendment retaliation and taxpayer funding is considered retaliation in that classic sense that it's a harm legally, that remains to be determined. But I think that there is a really good case, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, for the precedent value of this, even though I think NPR is totally biased. I don't think that they should receive taxpayer funding. But is this the right precedent? I think that remains to be seen. And so the key precedent here for people want to look up this case maybe is the Board of Commissioners versus Umber, U-M-B-E-H-R. It's a 1996 Supreme Court precedent that held that even government contractors can assert First Amendment claims if the contracts are not renewed in retaliation for protected speech. So I think NPR has a good argument here, but the better argument is the separation of powers. So a court may not even reach the First Amendment issue if they decide that Trump, as the executive, doesn't even have authority for this executive order.
All right, Jen, Fred again. NPR is not a government entity. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Voice of America is?
Voice of America is my understanding, yes.
Now, Trump doesn't like them either. and of course, he's put a new boss in there. But do they have some right to funding that NPR may not?
So Voice of America as a government entity, if they, because, and we're assuming here, and I'm not exactly totally sure of their structure, I'd have to look into this, but they are specifically, my understanding is, an official international broadcaster of the United States government. So because it's part of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, likely it cannot assert the same type of First Amendment challenge that NPR can if Trump were to remove their funding. But they may have the same claim to a separation of powers argument to say that if there is a statutory construction that Congress is the one that is providing them funding, that the executive can't unilaterally take that away just because he doesn't like it. So it depends on how the agency was created. Is there executive oversight in terms of the funding? Is that legislative in nature? All of those questions are legal questions that I haven't looked into. But for Voice of America, they may be dissimilarly situated to NPR for purposes of the First Amendment.
Okay. I personally think that the president probably does not have, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just saying, just as a layman, that the president probably does not have the authority to cut funding for NPR. But I understand it. I understand the impulse because the Republicans in Congress, who now control both houses, even though they're slim majorities, they have resisted really reining in NPR, PBS, the National Endowment for the Arts, Planned Parenthood, all of these that get government funding. The Republicans, even when they're in power, just don't seem to want to touch these kinds of things. I think this is Congress's job to rein in or to cut off spending. And I certainly understand President Trump being frustrated with the Republican Party's inability or unwillingness to do it. I'll give you the last word before we let you go.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And conservatives need to be concerned about the precedential value of these types of executive actions overriding legislation and congressional intent, even if we like the preferred outcome here, because, you know, let's be honest, conservatives aren't really fans of NPR by and large. That doesn't mean then that we would champion something that goes outside the scope of executive authority just because it's Trump doing it. So I agree with you on that. And I do think that NPR likely will prevail unless Congress actually gets it together, and they could just very easily, like my guest said this morning, they could have just put $1 in the funding in this big, beautiful bill for NPR, and that would have solved the problem, and you don't even need to get the judiciary involved. So why is Congress making Trump do all the work? That should be the question.
Yeah. All right. Our guest has been Jenna Ellis, host of Jenna Ellis in the Morning, heard weekdays at 7 a.m. Central Time, and host of the on-demand podcast found at AFR.net. Folks, I do want to encourage you to listen to Jenna's program from this morning, because it touches on some of these issues, especially her interview with Michael Ferris, who I think is for National Religious Broadcasters, Jenna, is general counsel.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And AFA was part of that lawsuit that he discusses, and it's a great win for us as well.
He also discusses in there, and maybe we'll talk to you about this on another occasion, Jenna. He did a personally did a review. Well, look, I'm just going to – how much time you got?
I have a few more minutes, absolutely.
Okay.
No worries.
All right. So one of the things Michael Ferris discussed with you is the approach of the Democrats to everything President Trump is doing by judge shopping and then filing lawsuits. And we did cut some of this out, and I'll just get a quick comment from you, and then we'll let you go. Chris, go ahead and introduce the clip.
Yes. This is Attorney Mike Ferris saying Democrats are purposely suing President Trump in certain courts to get the rulings they want. Clip 10.
There were 287 cases that have been filed against the Trump administration. 89% of those have been filed in federal circuits where the majority of the judges were appointed by Democrat presidents. And within the districts, within the circuits, 95% of the cases had been filed in districts where a majority of the judges were appointed by Democratic presidents. That's not following the rule of law. It's showing that this is political litigation.
Okay, so Jenna, your comments on this, because this does go to the, now the NPR thing with President Trump, he may wind up losing that. I don't know. But a lot of the things he's doing, I think, are within his purview as the chief executive. And yet the Democratic Party and the left is waging political lawfare, and they are picking courts that will most likely side with them, knowing that since the Supreme Court can only take 100 cases a year, you file almost 300, you're going to get wins. I mean, this is what they're doing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And this whole interview is really worth listening to. And I'm glad that you raised this clip, because 287 cases, as Mike Ferris talked about, the Supreme Court only takes around 100 a year. And so this means that if the Democrats are forum shopping, they're going to these leftist judges, and they know that it's also in appellate circuits that will likely prevail and the Supreme Court doesn't overturn it, then they're going to have precedent that stays in place just because of the high volume of cases. And so this is classic lawfare. It's trying to rule by judicial fiat. It is not original intent at all of the rule of law. This is rule by the judicial oligarchy. And Mike Ferris's point was that the left not only has a lot more strategy to try to just rule by sheer volume, but they have a lot more funding. And the ACLU and all of these private law firms that are doing this pro bono to initiate this type of high volume of cases just within the first couple of months of the Trump administration, conservatives have nothing comparatively. And we need to remedy that so that we aren't just always on the defensive trying to stop bad litigation, but we can actually do the same thing except for advancing the rule of law and cementing good precedent in these circuits and in these forums, where we really need to have better precedent, even if the Supreme Court doesn't ultimately touch it.
What's your on-demand podcast this coming end of this week? Will you get something planned or
yes,
in process?
It's going to be very exciting. I have my good friend Dinesh D'Souza on, and he actually had a great podcast yesterday on his show talking about Elon Musk kind of stepping away from the administration and saying, hey, I tried to get involved in politics, and Congress isn't doing anything about Doge. They're not cutting spending, you know, a lot of the things that we've touched on. And so if Elon can't even do this, then where are we at as a conservative party? Why aren't the Republicans doing this? So I sit down with Dinesh for about 25 minutes and we hash this out. And I think his perspectives, and we've gone kind of back to, you know, Barry Goldwater and Reagan and the conscience of a conservative that was, you know, back in the 1960s all the way forward to talking about where we're headed and why Republicans simply can't get this done.
Sounds like a great show. All right, Jenna, thank you so much for being on with us, for staying a few minutes extra. We appreciate it.
Well, I hope that I'm not benched after this.
You're not benched.
So, thanks.
You are not benched. All right. Thanks,
Jenna. I appreciate
it,
guys. All right. Bye.
Bye. Very interesting what she's going to be talking about with Dinesh D'Souza. A lot of frustration out there. Elon Musk is a genius. Has, you know, the creative power to, create completely different companies. He's not the kind of guy who wastes his time trying to get things done when it's clear nothing will get done. A lot of frustration. I think there's a lot of frustration amongst conservatives with Republican leadership and with the Republican Party, because we have this shot to rein in the federal government, and boy, they just seem to be dragging their feet.
Well, we saw it in the first Trump administration when Republicans had control of the House. Remember what happened when he went asking for money for the border?
Yeah.
He ran into trouble with his own party.
Yep.
And now that the, you know, the big, beautiful bill is headed for the Senate, Senator Scott of Florida publicly saying yesterday, I'm not going to support it. We have Josh Hawley.
Yeah.
Saying we're not going to support it. And, you know, Scott saying, well, you know, the Republicans will work with it. Maybe we'll tinker with it. But if we make anything major, we have to send it back to the House.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's from a out here in the boonies,
yeah,
away from Washington, we look at this sort of thing and we say, you guys, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You have control and you've turned the guns inward.
Right.
On yourselves. You did it before and you're doing it again. That's one thing the Democrats do well.
Yes.
Right. When they get in power.
Yeah.
They coalesce.
The party that is for the Second Amendment is the best party at shooting itself in the foot every time.
Yeah.
Every time they get in there, they find a way.
Yeah. And for Elon Musk, you mentioned Elon Musk is used to running a company. You know, he's the big guy. And the order goes out, and the orders are carried out.
You know,
the problem is Elon Musk ran into the realization of what Trump and others call the swamp.
Yeah.
The swamp is big, and it's deep. It's just gotten worse and worse in its toxicity, its financial toxicity, over the decades. And to try to move that within months,
yes,
to change things in there. Because you see the way these employees, you may have a department that has 15,000 employees.
Right.
5,000 of them don't do anything.
Right.
You know, remember initially in Doge, they talked about all the people that were working from home, and we found out some of those people working from home had other jobs.
Yeah.
That they were going to.
Yeah, and these buildings were just about empty.
Just about empty. And we all found out about this, and we're scratching our head. How is this allowed to happen? But look where we are right now. We're several months into this, and I'm not sure much has changed.
Well, there's an old quote from, I want to say it's G.K. Chesterton in the early 1900s. And he said, he wasn't just saying Democrats and Republicans. He said, the job of progressives is to make mistakes And the job of conservatives is to make sure those mistakes don't get corrected. And yeah. I always thought that is a brilliant analysis of the inability of the Republican Party and conservatives to make important changes because their primary instinct is to preserve the status quo. But what if the status quo has been created by a bunch of far leftists? You've got to change things back, and they seem unwilling.
Jenna made the comment, if Congress would get its act together. I have been in news, not as long as you guys, but I have been in news for almost 25 years. If I had a nickel for every time I've heard or quoted somebody say, if Congress would get its act together, Jeff Bezos would be paying me to go to space. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say, it's true, Congress should get its act together. She was 100% accurate. I totally agree with her. But unfortunately, we're going to be talking about, if the Lord tarries, we're going to be talking to somebody 5, 10, 15 years from now who's going to say, well, if Congress would get its act together, I guarantee you.
Well, and to your point, which I think is a great one, Fred, about the swamp in D.C., not all the creatures of the swamp are Democrats.
That's right.
There's a lot of Republican creatures of the swamp. And listen, I think there is growing discontent out there. People who are tired of people going to Washington, supposedly to serve the rest of us, and they come out as multimillionaires.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. It's beyond our ability to comprehend how you think you're a public servant. If you're making a bundle while you're up there, and then when you leave, you make even more.
Yeah.
I don't know where that frustration is heading. Maybe to members of Congress getting primaried coming up. Who knows? But it is a very frustrating situation, and I'm guessing that's what drove Elon Musk out.
Yep.
Just tired of it. All right, we're going to take a five-minute break for news. And when we come back, more of today's issues. Hope you join us.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.